Joy and I recently finished watching the Netflix series Cobra Kai. The storyline begins 30 years ago, after the events in the classic 80s film Karate Kid, which focused on the conflict between Daniel LaRusso, who was learning martial arts from an older master from Okinawa, and a group of bullies who harass him. The Netflix series portrays Daniel as an adult facing challenges in running a karate dojo based upon the principles taught to him by his beloved master. I lost count of the number of times Daniel says that he wishes he could seek counsel from the deceased Mr. Miyagi, who would surely point out the wisest course of action in very confusing situations. Now, normally there's a flashback to the original movie where Miyagi always seems to have the best answers and the most sage advice. Of course, this trope is common in all martial arts films where an older master seems to be training a novice who is, and the master is always wise and shrewd. Our culture loves to portray older, wiser figures in coming-of-age stories. In the worlds of fantasy and science fiction, there are numerous characters who fit this description. Obi-Wan Kenobi, Gandalf, Dumbledore are obvious options here. The grizzled Mickey in the Rocky films fits the bill as a worldly wise, gritty character, as does Clint Eastwood's man in Gran Torino. Robin Williams had two famous roles of this kind, Mr. Keating in Dead Poets Society and the counselor Sean in Good Will Hunting. TV portrayals of a mature Queen Elizabeth II, like The Crown, show her as seasoned and prudent. Of course, there's always Judi Dench's character M in the James Bond franchise, and Maggie Smith's great Dowager Countess character in Downton Abbey. My wife would be very mad with me if I failed to mention some Disney favorites, so here we go. Merlin, Mary Poppins, Mufasa, Rafiki, Aladdin's genie, and of course, the fairy godmother. When these beloved characters hand out good advice, it seems to scratch a deeply held cultural itch for reliable models of wisdom. In a very shallow society, these mentor figures rely on traditional outlooks and tried and true viewpoints to provide some level of grounding and direction to their younger friends. There seems to be a tacit admission that contemporary culture lacks depth. More often than not, it gives bad advice and it models wrong values. Without the voice of wisdom speaking out a better perspective, we all feel adrift and lost in a sea of short-sighted and foolish opinions. We've been looking at different types of psalms in this occasional sermon series. So we've looked at psalms of lament, psalms of ascent, psalms of appeal, and the last one was messianic psalms. Now there are about 25 psalms whose primary purpose is the cultivating of a proper perspective for wise living and decision making. So today let's look at a few psalms of wisdom so we can catch a glimpse of biblical wisdom and its reliable outlook on life. The first psalm is Psalm 19, the source of wisdom. I will deal with verses 1 to 4 first. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. The voice is not heard, but their voice goes out throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. So this is a poem of David, and he actually identifies two sources of wisdom for those with eyes to see and ears to hear. In the first section that we're looking at now, he just simply says, look up. The heavens are shouting out praise to God for the beauty of his creation. The sky itself is marveling at craftsmanship. There is no human voice, but nonetheless, there is delight in the handiwork of God throughout every corner of the earth. So this poem, which expresses the expressiveness of nature, echoes this great psalm, which Carol read for us. I consider your heavens the work of your hands, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. Psalm 8. So David wants us to ask ourselves, what kind of wisdom is proclaimed in the skies? Nothing less than a testimony to the power of the Creator, who can make such glory. The circuit of the stars in the solar system, the regularity of movement, the reflected light shining in the night sky, all of these proclaim the order that God has infused in his creation. The design of the cosmos is stunning, and David takes great joy in it. In verses 7 through 13, continuing on, we get the second source of wisdom. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. Moreover, by them is your servant warned. In keeping them, there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Declare me innocent from hidden faults. Keep back your servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression. So David here, the psalmist, makes a sudden transition from considering the heavens to now reflecting on the law of the Lord. And he says that the instructions in God's law can make the humble wise and enlighten our eyes. In the unveiling of wisdom to those willing to see and hear, there is a reviving of the soul. So, what are the benefits of listening carefully to God's guidelines? David clearly says these commands keep glaring sins and hidden faults from reigning over us. For who can discern his own errors, he asks. This man after God's own heart knows from personal experience that every heart is desperately misguided and self-deceiving. Without these boundaries, we all go off the rails. But those who delight in the law of the Lord, to echo Psalm 1, flourish like a tree planted by the streams with fruit and leaves. Now, why does David link together the witness of the heavens and the testimony of the law in this poem? He seems to be suggesting that there is a structure, an order, and a freedom within limits at the core of the creation. So the stars move within a natural design. Those who are wise perceive the patterns, whether it's in the spheres above or in our hearts within. Those who are humble acknowledge that there is this creator who designs such glory, and he must know the proper boundaries. We listen carefully to the instructions. Those who are fools, who act like there is no God, ignore the guidelines, and then they are dominated by their own sinful patterns. So David defines wisdom as perceiving God's greater design and living accordingly. Last weekend, I went down to the Sims bowling alley by the turnpike. To make it a little bit more interesting for myself, I decided that I would try an experiment, and I would release the ball with enough spin, I hoped, where it would hug the edge of the lane and then suddenly curve back at the last moment for a resounding strike, because the spin was just perfect. Well, I ended up throwing mostly gutter balls and not too many strikes. Now, I have a 6-year-old niece who sensibly had bumpers placed in the sides of her lanes. And guess what? She never threw any gutters. In fact, she pretty much had all strikes and spares that evening. So she already had grasped a very useful life lesson, which apparently I haven't quite grasped. Bumpers in the bowling alley are there for your success. Now, my case, testing the boundaries, resulted in my high score, which was 25 out of a possible 300. So, okay, the next psalm of wisdom is Psalm 49. The outlook of wisdom. And I'll handle verses 12 to 15 first. Man in his pride will not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence. Like sheep, they're appointed for Sheol. Death will be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Now, in the Old Testament wisdom tradition, there is this strong emphasis on facing death. It's just simply there. The book of Ecclesiastes is a meditation on the fleeting nature of human life and the futility of things pursued without reference to God. This psalm tells us the undeniable truth that every life of every man and woman cannot remain. Sheol, of course, is the Old Testament word for the grave, and it awaits each person. But instead of falling into despair, the poet has hope that God will ransom his soul from death and receive him into his presence. It is the personal relationship between the psalmist and his Redeemer that is going to overturn the power of Sheol. The upright life will be vindicated in the morning. Like the previous psalm, humility and trust are the wise responses as creatures to our Creator. In stark contrast, a proud man or woman is like a beast that perishes and is no more. That's what the psalm says here. Death is their shepherd, and it leads them away from rest. Their very form will be consumed. Now that's frightening language. It is the height of foolishness to ignore the fact that every human has an expiration date, with either ultimate love or ultimate loss at the end. Continuing on to verses 16 through 20 of Psalm 49. Be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases. For when he dies, he will carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though while he lives, he counts himself as blessed, his soul will go to the generation of his fathers, who will never again see light. Man in his pride, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. Okay, here's a word to the wise from this psalm. Present prosperity is no guarantee or marker of God's blessing if the wealthy live with an attitude of pride. Solomon in Ecclesiastes agrees. Though they might count themselves as blessed, the accomplishments are transitory. They are fleeting. They're here today but gone tomorrow. Trying to keep hold of them is like chasing after the wind. The glory of houses and possessions may increase, but when life is gone, everything comes to an abrupt end. And the psalmist warns that in death, the proud will never again see the light. Everything suddenly crumbles. They are like irrational beasts that perish in a state of ignorance. Strong words indeed. In Rome, there is a very famous mausoleum in the next picture called the Capuchin Crypts. So in order to remind themselves that life is temporary, these monks, literally, I'm not making this up, they display skeletons of their dead companions in the crypts. Human skulls line the walls. Even the altars in the crypts are made of human bones. And there are messages written in Latin like memento mori, remember death. Or the really picturesque one, I was once like you, you will soon be like me. So I didn't hang out too long in those crypts. I got out of there pretty fast. But I did get the point. So their point came through very strongly. So in both of these opening psalms, wisdom is expressed by having the right mindset, understanding the true nature of the human condition. Now this outlook is long-term rather than short-term. It adopts a wider perspective rather than a nearsighted one. We're creatures. We live within boundaries. There are patterns in the created and moral order. If we posture arrogant independence, then we face our own peril. Like it or not, we are mortals that are walking towards death, and we dehumanize and damage ourselves if we have misguided pride. The ancient Hebrew poets say it's much wiser to place your confidence in the guidance of a loving Creator and a Redeemer. Another psalm of wisdom is Psalm 37, the blessings of wisdom. And I'll take it all in one chunk. Better is the little that the righteous has than the abundance of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked will be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous. The Lord knows the days of the blameless, and their heritage will remain forever. But the wicked will perish. The enemies of the Lord are like the glories of the pasture. They vanish like smoke. They vanish away. The wicked borrows but does not pay back. But the righteous is generous and gives. For those blessed by the Lord shall inherit the land, but those cursed by him will be cut off. The steps of a man are established by the Lord when he delights in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be cast headlong, for the Lord upholds his hand. Now, in this Psalm of David, it's another Psalm of David, he sets up a contrast between the righteous and the wicked, which you find in wisdom literature. The central verse identifies perhaps the key difference between the two types of people. Those who are wicked do not pay back what they owe, whereas the righteous give with generosity. Now, this difference is a clue to their overall attitudes and mindsets. The righteous have genuine compassion for others, and they prove it by acts of giving and charity. They offer what they have to God to bring him glory, to spread his love. The wicked hold back their money and resources. They display greed and selfishness by a lack of generosity. And so Jesus warns, no one can serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money. Now, the psalmist admits that it is very possible in this life for the wicked to enjoy a lot of abundance, due in no small part to their self-centered mindset. And it is possible for the righteous to have comparatively fewer material goods and less affluence than those whose God is money. We all can make a list of people who are doing just fine and doing actually very well in life as a result of their self-promotion, their bullying, and their deceit. Having moved within multiple Christian organizations over many years, I've noticed that sometimes the ambitious rather than the godly rise to the top. Sometimes. It can be very frustrating to see people prospering and enjoying the fruits of these kind of self-centered deeds. But David takes a wider perspective. Better is the little of the righteous than the abundance of the wicked. And David shows us why the righteous are in a better position. They are known by God. All their days, all their actions are seen by him. The psalmist affirms that the righteous are upheld by God. Even when they fall down, they're not cast away, but the Lord holds their hand and raises them back up. The psalm promises that they will inherit the land, which is David's shorthand way of saying they'll get their reward in the kingdom. The dominant theme of the fleeting nature of life is repeated by David, and he compares the glory of the wicked to a green pasture that fades away and to smoke that vanishes. Perhaps the most poignant verse in this passage is that God directs the very steps of the righteous, and he finds delight in his children. When the godly display generosity, they reflect the very heart of God towards his creation. So for David, wisdom in this psalm is found in renouncing a self-centered outlook, perceiving God's giving heart. Perceiving God's giving heart. Wisdom is developing an attitude of charity and being open-handed with your gifts. And yes, and this is hard for me, but a wise perspective involves not getting frustrated over the short-term prosperity of the wicked, because we see the bigger picture. Okay, two shorter psalms to round out our series here. Psalm 146, the focus of wisdom. This is a timely one. Do not put your trust in princes, in a son of man, in whom there is no salvation. When his breath departs, he returns to the earth. On that very day, his plans perish. Blessed is he whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord his God, who made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, who keeps faith forever, who executes justice for the oppressed, who gives food to the hungry. The Lord sets prisoners free. The Lord opens the eyes of the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. In a kind of spin-off of our previous themes, this poem reminds us that we cannot and we shall not place ultimate hope in any human leader, whether they are cultural, political, or even religious figures. Every prince is a son of man, our psalm says here, or a son of Adam in the original Hebrew. Adam literally means earth or dust. As soon as the breath fades, every son of Adam, or daughter of Eve, to put it in Narnia language here, returns to the earth, dust to dust. Although powerful and charismatic leaders appear strong, like they might provide us security and abundance, as soon as their lives are taken from them, their plans perish on that very day, it says. It is foolish to look to mere humans for stability and comfort, no matter who they are. They cannot provide salvation for our souls. Instead, the psalmist says that all hope, of course, should be directed to the Lord. Why? Because he keeps faith forever. And the word translated as keeping faith implies faithfulness, integrity, and truthfulness. Now, God is the keeper of his promises and his word in these types of psalms. He is deeply concerned about the oppressed, the bowed down, and the hungry. In Psalm 3, David expresses his confidence. You, O Lord, are a shield around me, my glory and the lifter of my head. So in this wisdom psalm, Yahweh is pictured as raising up the weak, protecting the vulnerable. He has the power, for he makes heaven and earth, and he has the compassion, for he loves the righteous. This psalm makes things crystal clear. Blessed are the wise whose trust is in the Lord, the everlasting covenant-keeping God. Pitied are the foolish whose hope is in earthly people, who cannot sustain their own lives, let alone offer security or salvation to others. And my final short psalm is 127 for Wisdom Psalms, the security of wisdom. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives sleep to his beloved. So this is a psalm of Solomon, and he makes a huge claim. All human activity depends upon the Lord for true fulfillment and lasting significance. You can toil all day long, rising up early in ambition, staying up late to bring your plans to completion, but it is all anxious work. It is all ultimately in vain if the labor is not blessed by God. Now, the word toil reminds us of the curse of Genesis 3, where fallen and now mortal humans are condemned to toil and sweat to get their food from the ground, which is now overrun with thorns and thistles. This allusion to toil serves as a warning that self-centered striving is a never-ending struggle that leads eventually to frustration. Elsewhere, Solomon in Ecclesiastes says that there's nothing better than for a man or woman to find their satisfaction in their work, but that this is a gift from God. The enjoyment and the security of life's greatest gifts can come only from the hand of God. Rest, contented sleep, is only given to the Lord's beloved ones in this psalm. The watchman can stand guard all night, but unless God watches over the people, there is insecurity and worry. We all know people who never find contentment, even in their lives of plenty. And we all know others who find satisfaction in their lives of simplicity and gratitude. Wise King Solomon here in this psalm encourages us, yes, plan, work, rest under the gaze of God. But he also warns us not to toil and strive without acknowledging God or asking for his grace. In conclusion, in a time of mass media, artificial intelligence, and high-speed internet, we are awash in information and viewpoints. Influencers provide a steady stream of opinions regarding what a happy life should look like. Of course, this revolves around self-gratification and the acquisition of things. Those most savvy in the game of life can maneuver and arrange their environments to meet their goals. Most decisions are made without reference to anything higher than present comfort, status, or pleasure. And the worldly wise seem to meet these objectives with great success. And sadly, the outlooks of these older, wiser figures are drowned out. And their sage advice, based upon tried and true experience, year after year, is dismissed altogether. But the Psalms push back on this narrow mindset, labeling it as short-sighted, vain, and foolish. Instead, they hold out a higher, broader, and longer-term perspective as the basis of true wisdom. We are creatures, and we live in a world made with boundaries. Bumpers in the bowling alley are very helpful. To step outside the moral order of the Creator is just asking for trouble. The wisdom Psalms remind us that we are mortals, and we journey in the direction of the grave, like it or not, and our only hope is in a Redeemer who will resurrect us and reward our generosity to others. We cannot place ultimate hope in any humans, for they are fallen and conflicted. Only God is worthy of unwavering trust. And although the wicked may enjoy temporary success, in the greater scheme of things, only the righteous can retain their blessings and enjoy them in this life and in the next. Wisdom in the Psalms is about cultivating a wider angle perspective and letting it influence our choices. It's about perceiving God's greater pattern and living accordingly. This outlook should lead to humility and a desire to see things from God's viewpoint. It keeps our natural inclinations of ambition and pride in check. It protects and provides us with a life of lasting significance. And a final word to the wise from King Solomon himself: unless the Lord builds the house, they who build it labor in vain.